Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Allison Beard. The kind of work we do has always been linked to where we live, from the days of the farmers living, well, on farms, to the sailors, longshoremen, and financiers in the port cities that first powered global trade, to the assembly line workers and tradesmen in the factory towns that drove the industrial age. Intellectuals, artists, and knowledge workers, what our guest today calls the creative class, have meanwhile long clustered in big urban centers like London and New York, with service providers following and all of it spurring economic development and sky-high property prices. But how has the rise of remote work and its accelerated adoption through the pandemic changed that? Now that technology allows us to work from anywhere, are big cities on the decline? Richard Florida is a professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, and his latest research, conducted with Boston Consulting Group, paints a more nuanced picture. He's co-author of the new HBR article, The Rise of the Metacity, and he joins me now. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Allison. It's great to be with you, and thanks for having me.
So I explained a bit in the intro, but give us your quick version of why cities have always been a hub for commerce and the creative class.
If you think back for all of the millennia before now, a city, a human settlement, a place where people and businesses and economic activity gathered was always physically delimited. First, it was bordered or bounded by how far we could really walk, and maybe then how far we could ride an animal, a horse or a mule. And then we began to develop these technologies, a horse-drawn streetcar, and that expanded the boundaries of a city, of a human settlement. And then we developed, you know, subways and trains, and then automobiles. And with every one of these major technical advances, we kind of expanded cities outward. And they got bigger and bigger until you got Tokyo or New York or London. Then we got COVID. And it's interesting. We had developed these digital technologies before COVID, e-commerce was certainly here with Amazon and other grocery delivery. And there were digital technologies, email, the internet. But I think what the pandemic did was create this kind of big, giant experiment in the use of these digital technologies. And the idea of a metropolitan area, this is important. You know, the basic definition of a metropolitan area, which is our basic character of human settlement, a city and its surrounding suburbs and hinterland, is a shared labor market. How far you can physically commute to the city center. Mm-hmm. Well, I think these new digital technologies, they allow physically bounded cities to create, I guess, what I would call digital hinterlands. They allow cities to connect to outside areas. So what we are not seeing is what the media portrays. What the media portrays is the rise of Zoom towns, independent, self-acting places, some of them being large, like Miami or Austin, some of them being small, like the Hudson River towns outside of New York or Bozeman, Montana. Ironically and or paradoxically, even as big central superstar cities like London or New York may see population out-migration to these new up-and-coming rise of the rest places, their centrality in the network may become ever stronger. And so we're saying that it is a hub and spoke network, not only a physically co-located place, but a city which has digital interconnections with other cities. And there's a structure and logic to that that we need to understand. And really, we haven't been talking about. We've been talking about separate places, not really the network of places and how they fit together.
So talk to me a little bit more about the research you did to provide evidence of this phenomenon of the metacity, this hub and spoke flow of talent.
Well, it's very hard to get at everything. And you know, you'd want spectacularly robust data on digital connections, Zoom connections, airline flights. But we said, if you think about what makes the knowledge economy tick, it's no longer just access to raw materials or access to physical labor or big endowments of capital and technology. It's flows of talent. I mean, ever since I wrote Rise of the Creative Class 2 decades ago, you know, that's become a mantra. The places that win are the places that attract talent. And so what we did was look at flows of talent between places. And the way we did that was just take data from LinkedIn that collates information on professional people, business people, technology people. So what we did was take the biggest cities in the world, the biggest metropolitan areas in the world, and looked at the flows of talent as collated by LinkedIn. So you could see where talent was going between places, which cities were attracting talent, which cities were losing talent. When people talk about the rise of new cities in the United States, they focus on three. Miami, spectacular growth of Miami as a new center, a hub of technology and finance, you know, new crypto high-tech center, Austin. Mm-hmm. It's luring high-tech away from the Silicon Valley. Nashville, a place with more affordable housing, great lifestyle, and so forth. Miami, Austin, and Nashville are very much self-contained, wonderful economies. But when you looked at the LinkedIn data, something becomes very evident. Miami's number one source of talent, where talent comes from and goes from, is New York City, far and away. If you went to the airport on a Monday or Tuesday morning, you would see flocks of commuters. You know, the kind of funny phrases, Miami is the sixth borough of New York. Miami is not so much an independent economy, but it is really tied to the finance and real estate industries of New York. Hmm. Austin, if you look at Austin's LinkedIn data or San Francisco's LinkedIn data, you see the two are tied at the hip. That Austin has really long been a suburb, if you will, or an outlying or a periphery, a hinterland of the San Francisco Bay Area technology complex. And Nashville, of course, when you look at Nashville, it's really tightly linked to Los Angeles. So those are just exemplifications. And then we were able to use the LinkedIn data to look at cities that are more or less central in the network. But once you do that, you begin to say, it's not just individual cities anymore. What these new digital technologies do is reinforce a network of relationships or a set of relationships. And again, I think it allows cities to expand their economic reach without expanding their physical footprint. And if in a way, in the past, the hinterland of metropolitan areas was the exurbs, the far out suburbs, and the rural hinterlands, the new hinterland has been massively expanded. That we call the meta city, a city which is no longer fundamentally constrained by its physical footprint, but where digital technology allows it to expand its economic reach through its digital interconnection.
Yeah, I have to say, I was glad to learn that the meta city is not in the metaverse. It is actually a real city connected to other cities. But you do seem to be suggesting that that's how it's going. You know, rather than people fleeing to the mountains or the beach, the talent really is moving back and forth between bigger cities and smaller cities.
Yes. And I mean, people may flee to the beach, people may flee to the mountains, but that doesn't mean their job is there. Even freelancers are connected to something. Their economic center of gravity. Let me give you another example. Ken Griffin says he's moving Citadel to Miami. Apollo says it's moving a bunch of things to Miami. Are they really? Mm. Most of what Citadel does still remains in New York City and to a lesser extent in Chicago. You know, Jeff Bezos said he was moving to Miami. Did he move Amazon to Miami? No. Most of Amazon stays in Seattle and its other centers. But people are able to telecommute, digitally connect to these places. In the past, cities were places to live and work. Maybe having a little bit of fun, live, work, play. I would say now that what cities do fundamentally are not just containers for living or working or playing. They are mechanisms and platforms for connections. And we see that in two ways. The first way we see that is the decline and transformation of the central business district. The central business district for most of the 20th century was a place people commuted to work. What central business districts are becoming is places that people connect. You know, I saw this several years ago when the pandemic was ebbing, and I went to visit New York City, and the office towers were completely darkened. But by about 4:30 or 4:45, there were block-long queues in front of every restaurant and bar. They were business people dressed in business casual attire going to meet one another to socialize and reconnect. A recent study by Paul Levy, who runs the Downtown Association in Philadelphia, actually looked at the rebound in 26 downtowns across America, in Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and so on. He found that about 10% of downtown activity is made up by residents, about 25% of downtown activity is made up of working commuters, and more than 60% of downtown activity is made up of visitors and tourists. Successful cities today, whether that is London and New York, which remain great places to live, great places to work, as expensive as they are, but they are principally centers of connection. And in our research, we actually wanted to create a master list of the most connected or most significant global megacities. And as you would expect, London and New York are number one and two. Mm-hmm. The next cities were the ones that were our giant surprise. Dubai, Dublin, Bangalore, Singapore, along with Paris and Los Angeles and some other more usual suspects. And there are certain cities in the world, and I think Dubai fits this bill, great airport, emphasis on restaurants, hotels, Miami, built up its airport, lots of convention and meeting activity. Singapore, spectacular airport, again, great bayfront development.
Yeah. I'm glad you highlighted the fact that this is an international phenomenon, but I noticed that you didn't mention any Chinese cities. So explain why they were left out of the research.
Well, we had real issue with Russian and Chinese cities because of the nature of those cities, what's going on, particularly in Russia, but also they don't really use LinkedIn as much. So it would be nice to get better data on them. I think the other way of thinking about this is that they're also more restricted. The flow of people is less vibrant in and out. Chinese cities are great centers of production. They're growing like leaps and bounds, but I think recent developments have made them less relevant as these centers of connectivity. You know, what's interesting to me, it's the relative decline in our rankings of Hong Kong. It's not as vibrant and open to the world economy as it may have been a decade or two ago, with the Chinese kind of increasing takeover or adoption of Hong Kong. It's really faded, and Singapore has shot up our rankings. The other place that is super fascinating to us, the Middle East is probably the single place in the world that best reflects the megacity. You have people who might prefer to live in Lebanon or Jordan or wherever, lovely, historical, wonderful countries and cities, Amman or Beirut, but can't find work. And they commute to places like Dubai or Abu Dhabi. And Dubai and Abu Dhabi and the Emirates have, of course, built themselves up as centers for this kind of work. Now, of course, Dubai has become attractive to people from the West, people from Russia, people from all over the world. They say that real estate prices are surging there. But also what you see happening in Riyadh and other parts of the region is they are trying to position themselves as these central kind of hubs to attract people. So in terms of these new spatial models or geographic models, the Middle East or Asia may more reflect the characteristics of the megacity than the older developmental pattern or the more historical developmental pattern in the West.
Okay, so I want to dig into implications for our audience. What does this mean for existing organizations deciding where to keep or move or set up offices, or startups deciding where they might want to locate?
So this is what I do. I'm an urban planner by background, but I've now been in a business school for a decade and a half. What I came to the Rotman School to try to do was think about the role of location and geography as corporate strategy. And that's why partnering with Vladek and Antoine at BCG have been so helpful for me, because I'm not necessarily a business person or business consultant. What we believe is that location strategy is a central element of corporate strategy, and it's been neglected. that corporate strategy talks about market conditions, competitive conditions, Michael Porter's competitive strategy. What we've tried to do is build on Michael's work and the work of others to talk about locational strategy, or what Vlad keeps telling me, not locational strategy, spatial strategy. When I wrote Rise of the Creative Class, Allison, and I don't think this has changed, nearly every single person I interviewed, whether it was an artist, a musician, a techie, a business person, said the same thing. I want to work on great projects with great people in great spaces, in great places. That does not mean necessarily a home office where you're isolated and alone, nor does it mean an office in a vertical tower sitting in a cube farm, bored, silly, and pestered, and you can't focus. You put your headphones on, and you're there because people are counting your hours. It means working on great projects with great people in great spaces and great places. And what it means for corporations is they have to take that seriously. Where do you put your central offices? Well, you probably put them in the central points of connection. You probably don't need as many cubicles for people. You need more group meeting spaces. You probably need headquarters in those areas that serve as brand statements, like great retail stores do. You also need to think about, where are the major hub locations for your people? Where are the places that you are connected to? And to think about where to situate your satellites and your hubs. Those may not be your fixed offices. Those may be use of co-working facilities. And then also, I think you need to think long and hard about how people work at home. So thinking really hard about what that portfolio of spaces look like, and then you're really developing an overarching spatial strategy. And then finally, this is what I teach to my MBAs. Many of our leading high-tech corporations, given the shift to remote work, think of locations as places on a chessboard that you can manipulate. I can move my headquarters from X city to Y city. I'm not being treated the way I want to in my home city, so I can shift production somewhere else. And I think that happened with Amazon HQ too. I think we've heard that sometimes with Elon Musk and Tesla. But people are super emotionally attached to places. They have deep feelings about the places they live. Companies need to think long and hard, not only about where to place offices and place economic activity, but also how to manage places. And I think, you know, maybe corporations need a chief locational officer. Maybe they need to develop more capacity on their boards to think about location and the geographic distribution of activities. So I think the flip side of this is not only do corporations need to be more aware of this, I think business people, management executives, young professionals need to take location much more seriously. And, you know, some people say, well, I want to move to this lovely place in the hinterland. Well, make sure that that place in the hinterland is connected to the things you want to be connected to. And if you want to stay in a big city, make sure you're in the big city that reflects the kind of career and opportunities you want. It's not a random chessboard you're on. There is a structure to this relationships, and you can place yourself in ways that are more effective.
Does this mean that we need to change the way that commercial real estate works? You know, you get economies of scale with having a big presence in one place. Long-term leases certainly lock you in. And that doesn't seem very compatible with geographic dispersion and flexibility.
I think if we go back to first principles, we have long been tethered to specific places. For all the reasons you said, we were tethered to farms, we were tethered to ports, we were tethered to big scale industry, and we were tethered to our desks. You know, I'm old enough to remember not having a computer, having a wired connection to my computer and a wired phone. You know, my kids just laugh. What is a wire on a phone, Daddy? A wired phone and a Rolodex. Well, digital technology has untethered us from all of that. So the whole idea that we need a desk to work in is superfluous. The idea of an office with cubicles is extremely redundant. People don't like working in that environment. They really dislike long commutes, but we are social animals. We love people. We need people. In fact, you know, if you read the sociological and psychological literature, we suffer from an epidemic of loneliness. So we need gathering spaces. It almost goes back to the point I was saying, as the central business district moves from offices to attractions, the office has to become an attraction. It has to become a place where people want to get together and do things.
So what do we do with all of those office skyscrapers and, you know, the big corporate campuses that many companies have?
Well, we had an experiment like this not too long ago. It was called deindustrialization. And there was a time that cities were Boston, New York, Pittsburgh, Detroit. They were factory towns. And at some point, beginning in the 1950s, but certainly accelerating in the 1970s and 80s, because of advances in technology, those factories moved away. They moved out of vertical urban environments to more horizontal. Ports moved, got containerized. They shifted their location. And for a long time, we thought that these cities were dead and defunct. But of course, some of those factories had to be torn down. Others and other warehouse districts were repurposed. They became great neighborhoods like Soho or Tribeca, areas of Brooklyn, go on and on about this. And other areas were torn down and rebuilt. The areas along part of the riverfront in Pittsburgh, where I lived for nearly 20 years. I think the same thing is true of the office areas. Now we have kind of a running experiment in that. You know, after 9/11, New York had to make a decision about how to rebuild Lower Manhattan. And I was part of that thinking, and we advocated that Lower Manhattan be rebuilt as a mixed-use residential neighborhood, not just offices, not just for commuters, and with an emphasis on creativity, arts, performing arts, music. So I think the point is, some of the towers can be reused as offices. If you follow commercial real estate, there's a flight to quality. These new beautiful office towers, one Vanderbilt and others, you know, they're commanding very high rents. They're exciting. And then some of the older offices buildings can be retrofit, but there's some that can't. I think the rise of the creative class and this young dynamic group of people who were drawn to cities in the 1990s and 2000s and 2010, they began to reactivate downtown. And so, you know, when you read, you know, Ed Glaser of Harvard and Carlo Ratti of MIT, two great friends, when they write in the New York Times, it's no longer the workplace city, it's the playground city. I'm not going to say cities are playgrounds, but they have playgroundistic elements. Downtowns have the most central locations. They have the best density of restaurants. They have the cultural institutions, the sports facilities. If you had asked me 20 years ago, I would have been against putting large cultural facilities in stadiums in downtown. I would have said downtown needs to be the sidewalk ballet of small cafes and artistic enterprises and galleries and music scenes. Now I would say with the absence of office workers and commuters, downtowns now need to be animated with all manner of great attraction, both for the local or regional visitor and also for the global business traveler.
Well, I think that's so important that businesses, you know, whether you're a huge employer or a startup, you do want to be a community builder as well. But one thing I have noticed in big sort of office, mixed-use retail, restaurant developments is that whether it's the fault of the corporations or the people financing it or the policymakers in the cities, they're not requiring schools and athletic fields and all of the things that make people with children want to live and stay in those places.
I think you're on to something quite profound, that in the future, if you want to build community and connective fiber, it's not enough just to provide an office with a desk and implore people to go there and talk to their colleagues. Having on-site daycare, having a nearby school, all of the things that leverage and, you know, it make it easier for people and enjoyable nearby restaurants and coffee shops and fitness facilities for people to work out. I think that's where we're headed.
And what does this mean for transportation?
Well, you know, this is something I agonize about a lot. It's funny, folks, how much the pandemic and this new meta city, this physical and digital city together, have caused me to rethink my views. This is why I think this is the biggest transformation in urban structure and urban economics I've seen, because it's forcing me as a scholar of this to rethink everything I thought I knew. You know, in the past, urbanists would say we need more fixed rail subways, more fixed rail transit to bring suburban and hinterland commuters into the business center. Maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, transit ridership is down. Rail ridership is down. Maybe we need to think about mobility in a different way. For me, I would think making sure that we have more complete communities where people can live and work and stay in their community, pricing our roads better, you know, making sure people pay for the use of the roads fully, and we should bear that burden. And then think about all sorts of other mobility strategies, you know, using technology better, sensor technology, you know, better timing of events. You probably don't need to even think about fixed transit until you get to be pretty big. You know, until you get to be over a metro of 5 or 6 million people, you can get around reasonably well with cars. I just thinking about the full complement of mobility, neighborhood-based, walking, pedestrian, cycling, the use of micro-mobility strategies, shared ridership, flexible transit. And I think that's something that's in need of large-scale rethinking.
What about connecting the hubs and the spokes that you're talking about, though? So, you know, obviously that seems to be happening with airlines now, but is it high-speed rail? You know, what is it that's going to connect these meta cities to all of their satellites?
Yeah, so, I mean, something else I think about a lot. You know, I was a big critic of airports and airport development, and I wanted to disprove that airports were key players in economic development, and I disproved myself. I found that airports with connectivity to a national environment and a global environment were one of the three or four most important drivers of economic development in cities. And that was 15 years ago. I think that would have gone up to one of the first or second, you know, along with talent clusters, high-tech clusters, business clusters, and highly educated people, airports. You know, in Toronto, I've been in this big debate. There are a lot of people who want to close our downtown airport. Our downtown airport is a lovely small airport with direct flight connections to Montreal and Ottawa, but also to Boston, Washington, D.C., New York, Chicago. And if we were to expand the runways there, we could have quiet electric jets that would enable connections to Europe or further afield. My view is having a downtown airport that can be walkable, pedestrian, quiet is an enormous asset. Others think it's a nuisance use. So my view is that air connectivity is critical and actually a big differentiator in how far you can be central in the network. Really depends on your air connectivity. And in some of the great cities, they have 4, 5, 6 airports. So I think that's very important. I remain a fan of high-speed rail. I think it's a great strategic solution to connect you to places that matter. You know, when I look at the Acela corridor, the Boston, New York, Washington corridor, their highways play a role, airports play a role, and the shuttle flights play a role, but also the rail connectivity plays a role. And I think that the idea of having these, I call them mega regions, these mega regions of 20, 30, 40, 50 million people that are as big as a country in terms of GDP, they're very important.
In talking about the implications for individuals, what would be your top takeaway for managers, leaders, the C-suite?
Well, I mean, and the U.S. is extreme in this. To make it simple, young people coming out of Harvard or MIT, or Stanford, or the University of Michigan, great universities, go to big cities. Lots of job opportunities, a big labor market with finance, real estate, management consulting, technology, arts, entertainment. Lots of other young people like themselves. Lots of places to go out at night. Not only a great labor market, a great dating and mating market. Lots of amenities, lots of things for them to do. But then what happens, of course, when they start to form a family, you know, you'll see the strollers there, but when they start to form a family and given the extraordinary price of housing, they start to go further afield. And I think what the rise of the meta city has done is meant that they no longer can just go to Westchester or New Jersey where I grew up or parts of Connecticut. Lots of those people can go lots of different places. They can go to Nashville. They can go to Austin. They can go to Miami. They can go to the Hudson Valley. They can go up to Providence. They can go to parts of Connecticut. And they can connect through digital technology and go in and connect with their colleagues. So I think for corporations thinking a lot about that, that you may have certain office areas or certain hub areas that are more for young people and certain that are more for families. And the young people may be in the urban center and the older people may be in satellite cities or in suburban office complexes. And then how do you bring them together? How do you bring them together so that necessary culture building and mentoring can occur through events and on-sites and off-sites? Dealing with that is going to be a bigger and bigger issue.
And for your MBA students, especially those who want to have, you know, high-powered, potentially global careers, how do you advise them on building that locational strategy?
Well, I mean, I let them do it, right? I built a decision tool called the Place Finder. I have them take that decision tool and literally write up a strategy memo about how they're going to deal with this based on career factors, lifestyle factors, housing, and all the rest. I just think more people need to expose them to it and choose the kind of place you want to be and understand that you may have to think of your life as not just one location. You know, my dad, perfect example. My dad left school in the seventh grade when he was 13 to help his family during the Great Depression. He got married to my mom. They bought a house in suburban New Jersey. My dad had one job in the factory for life, and they lived in one house for life. That's no longer the case for any of us. Most people in most corporations don't think about this as strategically as they should. Most people just make moves because it feels right. They moved for a friend, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, to buy a bigger house. It seemed like a nice community. My relative or buddy lived there. Most corporations, oh, I'm going to reduce my physical footprint. I'm going to save money on space. Making location a core element of personal and corporate strategy seems like the best advice I could give.
Well, Richard, thank you so much. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thank you very much.
That's Richard Florida, professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and co-author of a new HBR article on the rise of the metacity. And we have more episodes and more podcasts to help you manage your team, your organization, and your career. Find them at hbr.org/podcasts or search HBR in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks to our team. Senior producer Mary Du, associate producer Hannah Bates, audio product manager Ian Fox, and senior production specialist Rob Eckhart. And thanks to you for listening to the HBR IdeaCast. We'll be back with a new episode on Tuesday. I'm Allison Beard.